Hello, ladies and gentlemen, I am Luminous.
And I'm Rico.
And welcome to another episode of Top Deck Time. This is episode 25. But before we actually get started with the main topic of the day, I want to introduce my lovely co-host from the meh weather of Austria. It's Rico.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm good.
How was your week?
It's a very busy week. I have been casting Dota for the past 7 days. That's my girlfriend trying to...
Hi, Loomis girlfriend.
What's the podcast version of Photobomb? I don't know. Anyways, I've been casting Dota 2 for a week straight without any break. But that's over and behind me, so I get a nice break. And to talk about Eternal, I've played a lot of Eternal this week, so I'm actually looking forward to discussing it quite a bit.
Yes, well, let's get right down to it, shall we? We have some new spoilers to talk about.
Yeah, so there is going to be a new adventure coming your way. So think of Jax Bounty, but obviously right? New, I guess, for 25,000 gold or 1,000 gem. So this is actually pretty economical if you purchase it with gem. And there is a lot of people like Rico who has blinged out by buying the... Founders package, so you should have some gems lying around.
Yeah, definitely, and it's like 2.5 times the amount of gold you should have. You would have to spend if you don't buy it with gems. So I think I'm gonna just do it because I'm like I can always draft with gold or play events with gold, and like this time the raid on the gems is just very very efficient. If you have some gems lying around, I'd suggest buying it with those. If not, you can always grind the 25k, I guess.
I feel like DWD is always fixing their pricing a little bit just to see what earns more or less, I guess. Because this is actually very different, right? It used to be that like a draft is 5,000 gold or 500 gem. So this is slightly different. But regardless, we are going to get into the three cards that are spoiled. And starting things off, we're going to go with Devoted Dirge. It's a 4-power, 4/4 in time, double time influence. And 4 drops in time is completely crowded. But this one reads, summon, you gain 4 health. Pay 6 to give Devoted Dirge, +1/+1. You gain another health.
Yes, so it's a repeatable life force effect, which is pretty interesting, I think. The raid on the body isn't too great, to be honest. Like, when you look at time cards, you usually get a little bit more bang out of your buck, stats-wise. And the 4 slot is very, very much fought over. But this card is excellent, excellent, excellent against red aggressive decks. Like, if your plan is to beat down and finish your opponent off with, like, obliterates and some torches, this Devoted Theurge will... a thorn in your eye. Is that something you can say in English? It's a German saying, I guess. But yeah, it's very, very strong. Like you mostly have to 2-for-1 it. You can 1-for-1 it with removal, but then it almost traded with an obliterate. So this is a very, very strong defensive unit. And as such, I think it's a pretty good sideboard card. I am not so sure about the application ladder. I think you can't just throw this into any time deck and be happy. I think if you want to play this on ladder, you should be able to like leverage the life gain effect of the card.
A thorn in your eye?
No?
I think Americans have a saying called a thorn in the side or in your side. It's like,
oh, okay, fair enough. Annoying. Let's pretend that I said that then.
You know, in terms of against aggressive red decks, I had a crazy thought that this might actually be even better than Sandstorm Titan purely from a defensive purposes, because when you play the first Sandstorm Titan, they're likely to have a Vanquish / Annihilate. Most good aggressive decks always draw it. Whereas, I mean, this will be the first thing that will get Annihilated / Vanquish, but this gives you an immediate health gain effect. And if it does sit around... generally don't want to pay 6 to get +1/+1 and only 1 health, but if you have nothing better to do, it's okay.
Yeah, it's an okay mana sink.
It doesn't close a game like a Sandstorm Titan would, so it's pretty silly to compare the two cards, but it's just a thought I had. But I completely agree with what you said earlier. In terms of like playing it in the ladder, you definitely need to weaponize the life gain portion of it, because there's really no point to play a 4-power 4-4. In terms of two huge payoff cards, I think Mask of Torment is the best one, because it really doubles up. Mm-hmm. The life gain obviously increases the Mask of Torment. It helps you survive longer to take advantage of the Tormentor if you want to summon it. And then
you should interpret this as you gain more time to dawdle around.
Right, okay. Fair enough. And then you also pay 6 to gain more life, to gain more power, then to gain more life, to gain more power. So it's like an endless loop.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Like, it's very good with Mask on both ends. Like, sometimes when you play... I try to play a couple of Mask of Tormentor decks, but one of the things is that you end up with something ridiculous, like 50 power, and then you have nothing to spend it on. And this is an okay sink.
I think it's a great one, actually, but we'll see. I'm actually also interested to try this card with Katra, because the curve of Katra into Devoted Dirge on turn 5 to activate Katra, and then on turn 6, if you have another card, you could, play it to activate, or if you don't, then you could just use this guy's effect to activate again. It's not an ultimate.
Yeah, you can do this all over.
Yeah, it makes this a big threat next to Katra. Because currently the Katra mm-hmm. decks is like, if you have the one silence for Katra, the deck's over. This kind of adds a little bit more resiliency to the strategy.
Yeah, it's just a pretty efficient card if you can, as we said, leverage the life force a little bit. Overall, not the best card, but it has some very strong applications. I think that's about the power level that you can expect out of such an adventure.
I think you were making a point earlier that if you print Heart of the Vault in adventure, then it kind of makes it feel like you have to buy this.
And I think that's a pretty hard thing to balance for DWD, because you want to make the cards and the adventure itself like good enough so that people want to actually buy the adventure, but you have to be careful, because there's always critics in the community if they feel like a company is trying to lock something behind a paywall, which, to be fair, like, it's really hard to make that argument with this game. Like, I think that the game is very generous, so I think it's less of those voices will be heard, but you have to have that in mind, I guess. Like, yeah, as I said, like, Heart of the Vault would probably result in an outrage of the community, but you have to have something that makes people want to buy this.
Moving on to the second card here, we got Vision of Austerity. Is a Huru spell that costs 2 with 1 Huru requirement. Transform an enemy relic into an Omens of Austerity cursed relic. So for the first time ever, Huru's going to get themselves a way to deal with relics. We don't know what Omen of Austerity actually is. So let's start with the neutral case scenario. If this is just a 2-power, essentially destroy an enemy relic, do you think that's playable?
I don't think it is, just because Ruin isn't main deckable on ladder, and Ruin is way better. It also hits like Permafrost, for example, and it's a fast spell, and it's only 1 power and it's only 1 requirement, so it's just better in every scenario. Except for the fact, obviously, that Huru didn't have access to relic removal. Mm-hmm. I think it's way too weak as a main bot card. If like the Omen of Austerity cursed relic isn't something that's really annoying for your opponent, and even then, it's debatable, I think.
I mean, I guess we gotta see what the other side is, right? We need to know what Omen of Austerity does.
Obviously,
if all of a sudden, it makes them discard a card every turn, then we're kind of talking.
Right.
We don't know. We don't know what the effect is, so there's really no point to discuss it, apart from the fact that, again, there is now a way to deal with Relic from Huru, which is, you gotta spread out the hate a little bit. Kind of let that chalice be running around all the time.
So one thing I'm not sure about is how this interacts with the Sindel's Gift. Because if you transform in a Sindel's Gift, an enemy is a Sindel's Gift, the gift is actually attached to you. So I am not sure if the Omen of Austerity will be also attached to you, because the card doesn't really say that, or doesn't mention anything about reattaching the relic. So I am not sure if you wanted to get rid of an Sindel's Gift, if this card would be a possible choice for that. I'm not sure if the curse would then get attached to your opponent.
Well, I thought about that. They could easily word it as such. The owner of Omen of Austerity has the following negative effect. So it might still be attached to you, but then the opponent owns it. So then they're getting
that's possible, by it, so. I guess. I don't think they would do something like that just because it's not super intuitive. But I guess we have to see anyways with the card. We can't really know.
I think Relic is always in a sort of gray area where some of the Rune interaction is not very clear. I still hate the fact that there is like weapons and Relic weapons. I feel like a new player coming into the game would find that fairly confusing just simply by the way it's labeled and called.
Yeah, it's too close for the fact that they are fundamentally different.
Exactly, and very different at that.
Yeah.
For the longest time, I thought Cat Burglar got weapons. But, you know, he only got Relics. So, anywho, we got a 3-drop here coming out. It's called Auric Interrogator. 3 power 4/3 double shadow requirement. At the end of your turn, if Auric Interrogator has 5 swords or more, he deals 1 damage to you and draw a card. Now, you have to do a little bit of work to get this to 5 power, but if you do, you are rewarded by it.
Definitely. Yeah, this card is very interesting, I think. Like, I'm coming from an MTG background, and there are some, or a lot of effects, actually, that let you trade life for cards. And most of them are pretty powerful, just because, like, a card is usually more of, or a better resource than your life total. Your life total only matters when you reach 0, basically. They come in various degrees of playability, I'd say. So there was one very good card called Dark Confident, and it was also a unit that would once per turn let you basically trade life for cards. And the card is very, very strong, or has been in Magic for a long time. And they printed a couple of those effects of those creatures afterwards, and all of them were very hyped by the community, and all of them turned out to be not so good. So I am a little bit afraid that I might overvalue this card just because of the fact that I am a little bit biased because of the MTG example. But I think the card is actually pretty good. Body you get for the cost is actually decent. It's a little bit below curve, but just because you have the double requirement and 4/3 isn't like the greatest.
Okay.
But if you're in an aggressive deck, it's okay. It's it does the job. Like, it beats down. If you are aggressive and you need to fill your 3-drop slot, there are actually in Shadow not many cards that you can play. So it really depends on the faction you pair this with. So that's a bit of a plus. I think that it is, in my opinion, okay to play if you can't activate it as soon as you play it, or like every single time. And there's a couple of good ways to turn this on, I think. Like Oathbook, for example, in the Argentport aggro decks, or just the Finest Hour, honestly. If you can like trade a Finest Hour for one of the blockers and a card at the end of turn, that seems like a pretty good deal. And or like in Xenon, you have Xenon Obelisk. And if you play this in Justice or a Fire deck, you can always Warcry on it, which seems pretty strong.
Even though this is a double shadow card, to me, it has some Argentport theme attached to it simply because
of the Minotaur tribe.
You could also do the whole Minotaur tribal lore thing. That also will buff this up. But I was just thinking that Justice overall has the best ways to buff it up. You talked about Paladin Notebook, the Warcry mechanic, Finest Hour, Runehammer is always good. There's also the Letherite Falchion. Interesting to note that if you attach Lifesteal to this guy, then you don't actually lose any damage because he deals one to you and then you lifesteal off of yourself and draw a card.
Right.
I think bringing up the Dark Confidant comparison is somewhat interesting because the knock against Dark Confidant, as good as he is that you have to essentially survive one turn cycle with it because Dark Confidant's effects happens at the beginning of turn. And I think the powerful thing here is it happens at the end of your turn. So if you spend some resource to try to get this effect, your opponent has to answer it right then and there. So if you go Auric Interrogator and, like, let's say play a weapon, you're likely gonna not get 2-for-1 if they go Deathstrike, right? Or, well, Deathstrike's a bad example because they could Deathstrike anytime.
Actually, they can't. If you play a weapon on this and pass the turn, you get to draw the card. They don't get a pause then.
Oh, right. They don't have a window to answer.
Yeah, they don't.
There you go. Well, perfect example. Then you don't get 2-for-1. You get the payoff immediately. On that note, I think Auric Interrogator is a very, very strong card. I'm definitely interested to try out in various different shells, including the Minotaur Tribal Lord, because that's just sweet. Maybe a good Gauntlet deck or something.
I actually want to go back to that, though, because I think Auric Interrogator usually will draw the card later, because it's very hard to like play this and immediately enable it.
Okay.
Like on turn 3 and 4, it's pretty much not doable unless you want unless to like put a Wyrmwood on it or something. Yeah, unless you walk right it, obviously. But like that's also not super likely to happen. Like this would have to be like the third card on top, and you'd have to have one Walkrai unit that gets to attack. No, and even then it doesn't, like, you would have to have an Oni Ronin. It doesn't work without an Oni Ronin. I guess you could inspire on it or something like that. But my point is, it's hard to immediately activate it, and then if you can, like, if you play it and then next turn play a weapon on it and attack, you get the card at the end of your turn, whereas could have gotten it at the start of your turn, if that makes sense. But like comparing a Magic card to an Eternal card doesn't make sense at all, so I will spare the business. It's probably not a good idea to bring that up.
I mean, I think it's at least interesting to talk about it from a design perspective in terms of...
Right.
I think it's somewhat unfair to compare like mana per mana what you get from each, each game, I think, because things are cost a little bit differently, but... Design-wise, I think it's interesting to look at. But yeah, those are the three cards that we got in terms of the spoiler. We will talk more about these cards if more gets spoiled, but you had a tinfoil hat theory that it will come out sometime this week?
I think it's possible that it's going to be released on Friday. I have nothing to base that on, so it's just like a wild theory.
If it does get released on Friday, then
Then I was sure all along.
All right. Okay, so let's move on from the spoiler discussion and talk about getting to High Masters. Here at Top Deck Time, we are very serious about laddering. Well, not really, because we play a ton of meme decks. But when we do talk about deck discussion, we talk about, you know, how to tech it against the meta decks of the field. Mm-hmm. We're somewhat serious about getting to Masters. Carla, your girlfriend, has developed a surefire special tactic way to get to High Masters. So why don't you share the secret here?
After we got Masters in Draft League, we wanted to get Masters in Constructed as well, obviously. But we didn't have any idea what to play. Basically, nothing really spoke to us in an engaging way. Like, we wanted to climb, but we had no idea what deck to pick. So Carla came up with this idea. She said, well, we just play any deck for now, and then we play as long as we win. And at the moment we lose, we switch decks to the deck that beat us. So basically, that's what we've been doing this week. Play like 65 games, switch deck every time we lost, and switch to the deck that beat us. Obviously, we don't have the exact lists, but you get a good impression what you're up against. And for the known meta decks, you can just take a list. If you play against some brew, you can just add the people and ask them what they played, or just figure it out for yourself. And it has been a lot of fun, and it has been very educational, even in a couple of different ways. Like, first, I want to say it's a pretty cool thing if you, like me, are into deck building, because you get to basically build a deck after each game, unless obviously you play or you get assigned a new deck that you already played with. But for me, that has been a nice, like change of pace. Like, I played some games and then I could build a deck again and then play some games, build a deck again. It has been a pretty good change to just hit the play again button. And also, we took way more notes and tried to remember everything our opponents played. And in general, we were more engaged with each single game just so that we could make sure that we were able to recreate the deck or see if he's playing any or she's playing anything out of the ordinary that we would have to include. So it made us pay closer to attention to the games, which, well, it was more fun. And I honestly think that we just played better just because of that. The biggest thing is that we learned a lot about our metagame. And I think, like, speaking of a personal metagame, does kind of make sense in Eternal, just because you do get paired against a lot of the same players if you play a longer session. Like, we've run into the same people at multiple accounts, and also, like, you're playing on your own MMR, so people on your level, quote unquote, might be playing another meta game. For example, we played against 30 different archetypes. We took note of all of them. So within 65 games, 30 different archetypes, that's actually a whole lot of different decks that we played against. But like, there are people who take note and they literally play against the same decks all the time. So I guess the sample size is small, but I also think like this, that sample size is not the only thing that's working here.
So I gotta ask a couple of questions or kind of give a little bit of asterisks to this spectral tactics.
Shoot.
To get to High Masters. I think for the first, for people out there that are interested to try this, you kind of have to have a full collection because you're yes. essentially committing yourself to have the ability to play pretty much every single deck out there, which could include four Knucklebones, like, you know, some janky legendary, or could just include the full assortment of Combray legendary, the Titans, Ascendants, the Marsh Arendorns, the Owls, and stuff like that. So would not recommend it to new players out there, but for more of the, I guess the players have been playing for a long time and perhaps is feeling a little bit burnt out, I guess, in terms of not sure what to play. This might be a good, maybe like a good afternoon of challenge for yourself to learn decks and also to build decks, like you said.
Exactly. Yeah, it's really something for players who have a complete pool and they just like, they feel like they've played it all, or they like don't really know which one to use to climb or just to play some ladder. Yeah, definitely. I can definitely recommend you trying that out if you are at that point in the game. If you're not, unfortunately, I think this might not be feasible for you, but maybe something to be learned. For example, I think just us paying closer attention, taking notes about what we play against, it did help us a lot to get a better understanding of the metagame and get a better feel of how people wanted to play on ladder in general. Just taking notes, even if you don't switch deck, I think can be quite good for you to just improve your knowledge on the ladder right now. So that's something you can take away, even though you don't have a full collection.
So hold up, like this, you made it sound like you're gonna for sure get master with this, but you're deck switching around quite a bit, and you must be not playing your comfortable deck sometimes, right? So it seems like this is actually a step back into getting into Masters, the way I'm listening to this.
Absolutely. So I wouldn't say it's a surefire way to get into Masters. I would argue that like you will probably lose more than you would otherwise if you didn't do this. Just because, you're playing decks that you're not super comfortable with. You are playing decks that might not be super teched out. You play your own versions of them and you might not have the perfect version. And you don't really get into a comfortable zone either. Like if you're playing like 65 games with the same deck, at the end of that 65 games, you will know that deck by heart and you will know the matchups. But if you switch around, you obviously don't get to get that knowledge. So it's not the most efficient way to climb. But I think it's a good prep work, just because you get to, after you like see what people want to play and what people are playing, you can choose a better deck for that to attack that metagame. And you like by playing on the other side and by playing on both sides of the matchup, you get a deeper understanding of that matchup as well.
Yeah, I think a good example of this is like imagine yourself running, but with sandbags as weights on you. Because I think at the beginning, when you're deck switching all the time, it's going to slow you down. You're probably going to lose more games due to unfamiliarity of the new decks you're playing, perhaps the metagame and how to attack it from the other side. But this to me is a really good way to improve you as an eternal player overall, because you're exercising those like deck building muscles. You are trying to learn a matchup, like you said, from the other side and kind of attack the metagame from a different direction. Yeah, you might lose a couple more games in the beginning, but as you play more and more, and if you do this frequently enough, I could definitely see, like, once those sandbags come off, you know, like, once you got used to it, you zoom in down the track. At least, that's how I think it could happen.
That's the idea. That's a general idea. But honestly, the most important thing was this was just a lot of fun. I've had more fun like playing like this on ladder than I've had in a long time.
Oh, are you supposed to have fun in this game, or?
I mean, I'm mostly trying to have fun. Okay. Don't get me wrong, I think winning is fun as well, but.
Well, I have no fun ever.
Yeah, I mean, that's because it's your job, right? You have to produce like a podcast, I've heard. So, I mean, for you it's work, but for me, sometimes it can be fun.
I don't know if people out there catch Rico's sarcasm, but I have quite a bit of fun Actually, we'll get to some of the fun decks we have played this week. But before we get to that, I want to do a quick follow-up on our new account experience, I suppose. Last week, we discussed an idea of, you know, creating a brand new account called Top Deck Time. You might have came across us in the ladders. We have, you know, finished grinding out the Gauntlet / Forge. We have built our Recano deck, and we're about to storm the ladder. So I want to let you guys know that we have essentially did part one of the go, which is build a constructive tier one deck. And the second, and honestly, the more boring part is actually getting master with it. But honestly, we had so much fun just like opening packs. And it felt like opening these packs that matters, right? Right now, when I have my full collection and I open another booster pack, it's like, oh, whatever. Oh, did I get a premium legendary? No? All right, whatever.
Yeah. No premium rare, no premium legendary.
In this new account, every pack that we open, we're like, oh, that's an uncommon that we need. All right, let's go. And it's just like such a different joy. And I know people always say DWD makes this game so free and easy to play. Just playing the new account again made me feel that feeling like times two. Now that they released the faction level up thing, it's just that much. There's the puzzles that you could get the extra golden. It's so easy.
And the first win of the day is a pack, which is amazing for a new account. That wasn't the case when we started playing. Yeah.
We'll release the episode on the new account experience once we have it all ready and prepared. Maybe once we achieve master. I don't think getting to the master is actually that important, but for the sake of the quote-unquote completion, we'll get there and then we'll record that episode. But just want to give you guys an update of where we're at with that one. But let's actually talk about two decks that we are having a ton of fun playing. And why don't you take the floor right now with the deck that you want to start with?
So the deck is Scene and Control. It's a deck that we actually lost against and got to play a couple of games with during the challenge. And the deck is basically, I don't know, if you are playing Gauntlet a lot, you might have come across the deck called Well, China's Will. And it's basically the most broken deck the AI has to offer, I think, without the special rules of the boss. It's basically a Scene deck that plays like mono removal and legendaries. So like it plays like Sense of Titans, Mystic Ascendants, Banishes, Annihilates, Death Strikes. Like the deck is absurd. Scorpion Wasp. I don't know. Like it just plays a ton of removal and legendaries, and basically that's the deck. I've been enjoying it a lot. It's playing a lot of cards early on that are strong against the aggressive decks. Like it's playing Suffocate and Annihilate, Banish, Varus Favor, Temple Scribe and Embecolite as early game, and Aeons. It's just early game defense. And then the idea is basically you gum up the board and trade one for one with your removal until your like late game card advantage machines can take over. And those are the Waystone Infuses and Mystic Ascendants. You get to get the game to a state where you are able to mostly draw two cards per turn to your opponent's one, and you just one for one them with removal and outclass their board with your giant units. Like you're playing Steward of the Past and Sandstorm Titan to stall the ground, and I mean in the case of Titan also the air. And you're playing the Wasting Infuses, they are 2/6, so they are excellent blockers as well. Then you just outvalue your opponent and bury them in the card advantage that the Infuser and the Ascendance and the Champion can provide.
I still have not drawn a single card off of Champion Mystery.
Oh, I have drawn a couple of them.
Let's talk about Champion for a second, right? It's a 2-power 7/7.
A 6-power 7/7.
Sorry, not a 2-power 7. That would be crazy. It's a 6-power 7/7, which in the current meta, when there's so many sixes running around the Carnosaurus, the Heart of the Vault, that's like a fairly efficient rate. And that's why Reality Warden is such a big threat in metagame. Of course, when you could turn it on the unblockable, you could break ground stalls if ground stalls do exist. Let's say against an illusion deck or something like that. But if it doesn't, it's still like a pretty big threat that your opponent has to deal with.
Yes, it is. And like it's also the idea is that like if this one unit can hold back two units of your opponent from attacking, you basically generate the card advantage again. Then like because of the nature of the deck and the unit it plays, there's actually not only against Illusion, that there are a lot of board stalls actually, and Champion is a great way to break that. And also against the more controlling decks, it's another threat that they have to answer come late game.
I played this deck a couple of times as well, and I was fairly happy with most of the matchups, except against decks that just tend to go late and just trade better than you. Chalice in particular, I don't really have a way to outgrind the Chalice, which, I mean, that's just Chalice's strength, right? Like, the deck is designed to outgrind you. So I found myself leaning super hard on the Banishes to, you know, break their Chalices. Every time they cast a Channel of the Tempest, I just feel like I couldn't win anymore.
Yeah, Channel is definitely very problematic card. Also, the fact that, like, if you sometimes you can just trade for the Chalices, but then they have such good defensive units that you have to commit more, and then they get you with a harsh rule. So it's definitely a problematic matchup. Don't get me wrong, it's winnable. I've won a couple of games against Chalice, but it's definitely one of the harder matchups. And also one of the very, very hard matchups is Voda combo. You basically can't win because you're killing them very, very slowly. And yeah, you have a lot of removal, but they have a lot of units you have to deal with. And they can generally outvalue you as well with their, like, they have Mystic Ascendance as well, but they have more focus on them. So they have more ways to enable them constantly.
The one thing that I am very happy with this deck is the Waystone Infusers. Because I remember during the spoiler season, we were looking at the card and we're like, oh my god, this is a card that we're so excited to play with. And then we never play with it because it just like felt a little bit awkward in all the other deck. I think this is the best deck for the Baystone Infuser because you actually, like, the idea of the deck is to sit around and essentially just one for one, and she's a good blocker and draws you cards off the top of the library, which is pretty much all you're looking for.
Yeah, I'm always extremely happy when I draw her.
Getting to a high power count with this deck definitely matters. Iron activation is definitely accomplishable. In fact, I have ultimated iron multiple times when playing this deck. Very happy. The one Sleepless Light, I think, is super spicy. I've been very happy casting it whenever I do draw it. And I think the one number is the correct amount of Sleepless Light in this deck. The list will be at topdecktime.wordpress.com. All right. I got the URL correct. Would you say that this list has tools against aggro and midrange and struggles slightly against some of the more later game control decks that just kind of go way over the top, way bigger than you?
Yeah, like, the control decks are definitely a problem. Also, I assume that Huru control isn't great. Armory, I don't think Armory is great for you either, honestly. But, at least if they're playing version that runs Shadow for Slay, I think in that case you're really not a favorite. But I've been very happy with the deck against the more aggressive decks, and I think it has the tools to, like, go toe-to-toe with Elysian, and I think it's favored against Praxis. I have been reasonably happy, and I've been doing some climbing with it. I've used this, we finished the challenge at Diamond 1, and then Carla and I, we took turns. She was playing Dragonheart, and I was playing this to try and climb, and yeah, I had a pretty even win rate with the deck, slightly favorable, I'd say, against what I played against. So it's not like the be all end all deck of Eternal, but it has a good win rate in now we are Masters, so I have a decent win rate in Masters. But most importantly, I think the deck is very enjoyable to play, so I've had a good time with it. That's why I chose to play this one rather than like Recano.
I mean, for the controlling players that enjoy it, I mean, I definitely see myself as a Dirtle player, so I definitely had a ton of fun playing that. But another deck that I've been really enjoying a lot is this big Recano deck that I've made by myself. So the story goes, my friend and I were on Skype one day, and I was like, I want to build a deck. What is a sweet card that nobody's playing but people should be playing? We kind of like bounce ideas for a bit, and then he goes, hey, what about Caleb? It's a card that's been around for a long time, and it's sweet. You know, it does something unique, and nobody plays it. So I brew a Caleb deck, and then I began with the thought process of, Okay, so how many units does Caleb's active have to hit to make the A cost body worth it, right? So let's start with one, right? If Caleb hits a weapon on himself, I don't think Caleb is castable. Like, A power for, like, let's say, on average, an AA charger. Like, yeah, it's okay. It's very easily dealt with Annihilate, Deathstrike, and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, one isn't great.
So then I ask, is Caleb hitting two things worth it? Caleb himself plus another, is that good? And I think two is really where it's starting to be good enough. And then once you hit three units, you're just kind of going off. So I kind of built a deck with that idea in mind. And then I was saying, okay, well, what is the best support color to fire? Because I don't think you could just like play mono fire and then go to Caleb. I don't think that works out. So I decided that Justice is the best support color, faction, because you get the harsh rules. You get the early defense in Vanquish, as well as Valkyrie Enforcer against Dawnwalkers. You get Copper Hall Bailiff against Go Wide decks, should you want to get it. And more importantly, because we recorded that episode with Tony G, he told me to play Privilege of Ranks. That's some card draw here for this deck. In fact, sometimes it's even better than card draw, because with this deck, you just want to hit power drop every single turn. And because you're playing Okano, you just get the nice like benefit of having essentially the armory package, right? So Sword of Ikaria, or a Runehammer, Rise to the Challenge for those Runehammers. You get the Throne Warden. My high end now is 4 Jek, 4 Ikaria, and 3 Caleb. So, you know, people are throwing out there trying to do Gree Piles. I think I have them beat, perhaps, on the Gree Pile, because I'm playing, you know, like, maybe 20 cards over 5 power or more. This is kind of insane. So I was like, okay, this is going to be a meme deck, right? I'm not going to do too well with it. Started playing this deck around maybe 800 rank on Masters, and I played it as high as 250. This deck was surprisingly effective. I don't know if it's because people don't really expect this strategy and thus is playing wrong against it.
They don't see the Caleb coming.
I mean, they definitely don't. I think this deck tackles the aggressive matchup very nicely because it is running it's running 4 assembly line as well. It acts as double duty as early game defense, and if you do draw them late, they're not really dead cards because it makes Caleb such as like a dangerous top deck.
Like, assembly line is great against like the aggressive fight decks, like against Skycrick or against Stone Sky. It's amazing. It mostly trades 2-for-1 and just preserves your life total, and then you can take over with your more expensive cards. They just get you through those early turns and trade for the early units.
Yeah, the amount of time that assembly line just blocked 3 Sandstorm Titan hits was just like kind of mind-boggling for me. I was thinking, it's like, why don't we play more assembly line as a purely defensive unit? I think the problem with sometimes is like that's just not good enough as a reason to include assembly line in the deck. But once I as, you know, plan A is assembly line defense, but then you sometimes get the plan B of like, hey, Caleb is just gonna go insane. There was one game where I had Caleb in hand, and I had 2 assembly lines, so I was like, okay, well, I'm gonna just double assembly line. If they deal with 1 or 2 or a couple of them, it's like, whatever, I don't really care, because there's just assembly lines. They didn't deal with any of them, so next turn I charged in with Caleb with 6 other Grenadin tokens, all wearing weapons. I definitely emoted, this is going to be good. Maybe a little bit BM. It was definitely a good time.
Did you get to live the Grimfen dream?
No. Why don't you actually tell people what the Grimfen dream is?
It's a Grimfen. He once played a Charge Rod deck featuring Caleb and the Instructor's Baton. Like the 6 power weapon that gives +3/+3, and you take the top 4 cards of your deck and put into play. You play like all of them that share a battle skill with the unit you put the weapon on. So he put a rod on some charge unit and he hit Caleb, which hit another rod into another Caleb, which was pretty insane. The Grimfen dream, it's basically like Caleb into rod into another Caleb.
Caleb has surprised me quite a bit because I've discovered recently that there's 3 weapons that immediately gains you health. So that's actually pretty nice. It's good for Hail Mary situations. You got the Let the Right Falchions. You got the Bloodletter. And
Healer's Cloak.
What's a Healer's Cloak as immediate health gain? So there was one game that I just got Healer's Cloak against Onboard Lethal on the other side. So I was like, okay, well, I definitely cheese the win. Another very interesting discovery I had with the deck is that Jekk is... I think this is actually a very good Jekk deck because Jekk wears the weapon extremely well. I mean, he's a 6-4 quick draw unit already. It's already pretty big, but once you put a weapon on it, he kind of just gets insane. I always thought Jekk was playable, but I couldn't really find the right shell for him. The fact that he silences a unit and essentially take a unit out of a turn is extremely powerful because you're in this deck, you're following up Jekk with Ikaria and Caleb. The fact that Jekk could, let's say, silence a Sandstorm Titan and then Ikaria comes down is such a powerful move that sometimes you kind of just surprise your opponent how quickly you could turn the table on them.
Definitely. So Lumi, I gotta ask you a question. Like, how much top end is too much? Because you're running like 4 Jekks, 4 Ikaria, and 3 Caleb. Isn't that like, aren't you like rewarded, quote unquote, with starting hands that just are like 2 Sigils and like 5 expensive drops?
I think right now what I got is too much top end. If I wasn't building a quote unquote Caleb deck, I wouldn't have the 3 Calebs. I think somewhere between 1 and 2 is the right amount. 1 being just the easy rise targets. 2 if you just want to have Caleb as more of your identity of your deck. The way I see Caleb is that he's the 5th, 6th, and 7th copy of Ikaria. When I rise a late game threat, I'm always thinking, okay, is Ikaria just better here? Yeah, Ikaria is just better here. There was not a single scenario, apart from the time where I had to go for the Hail Mary Caleb just to survive, and I got the Healer's Cloak. I think that's like such a corner case. I think Ikaria is just such a massively better threat, simply because you could safely attack Ikaria into open power. I think the only card that punishes both Caleb and Ikaria is like Scorpion Wasp. But apart from that, like, Annihilate doesn't get it, Deathstrike doesn't get it, Eileen's Choice doesn't get it. So Ikaria just dodges so much more removal from your opponent, and Caleb doesn't. So as sweet as a turn 7 play of Assembly Line into Rising for Caleb is, I always go Assembly Line and Rise for Ikaria because it's just like more of a for sure thing. Yes, the current version does have too much top end. If I would take it more seriously, I would probably go down to 1 or 2 Caleb, but, you know, I'm memeing. I'm having a ton of fun because that's what you do in Hearthstone. Or sorry, that's what you do in Eternal. and apparently, I'm having a very good time climbing to Masters. So I actually touch on the matchup a little bit. I think it's decent against aggro because Assembly Line is a godsend for a deck like this. It's also pretty insane against control decks, as you imagine, that you have 7 charge units as your 7 and 8 drops, and you could search for them and kind of end games. And Ikaria just like generates insane advantages for you, as you know from playing Armory and other kind of Ikaria decks. The only big problem I have with this deck is that Dawnwalker decks, the mid-range Elysian, the mid-range Praxis decks are a little bit rough. They can just run you over before you get to those critical Jekk, Ikaria, and Caleb turns. They do quite a bit of damage with their overwhelm units. And I think Recono as a faction tend to have issue with Sandstorm Titans and big dumb 5/5s. If you don't draw your vanquishes, your units just don't really match up that well.
But I mean, you do have 4 Jekk to like keep the Dawnwalkers in Jekk.
Yeah, Jekk's good against Dawnwalker, although sometimes when it gets to that point, the Dawnwalkers might have generated quite a bit of value. You might have gotten in a couple of times and your life total is quite low. I used to not run any Valkyrie Enforcers because they weren't red units that benefited from Caleb. And then I was like, wait, there's really no point to think with that line of mindset because if I don't survive against a Dawnwalker, there's no Caleb that's coming. So I used to have 4 Bailiff and 0 Valkyrie Enforcer. Now I had to have a 2-3 split to give myself a better game against both aggro and mid-range decks.
It does make sense that the deck isn't at its strongest against like time-based decks just because Armory is having trouble against those already, and like Armory's best bet is to get a 6-power Runehammer, which this deck has a hard time to do, except if it hurries into it, at which point it's probably too late.
I mean, you could rise into it. That's also a play. But yeah, you don't get the whole artisan into randomly drawing a big weapon to kill things. You have to specifically rise for it. And thus, you're taking a pretty big turn off to just get that effect. But yeah, generally, once I know it's an mid-range opponent, I have to play very differently. Sometimes I sacrifice early tempo just to make sure I don't miss power drops. Like, I just make sure I always play privilege whenever I can, because getting to those key points of Jack, Ikaria, and Caleb is how you win, and turning the corner ASAP is probably the best way to deal with those mid-range decks. I would definitely recommend this deck to anybody that's looking to try out something a little bit different. I had a ton of fun and a lot of success with this deck, which again initially surprised me greatly. That is our deck discussion this week. Any kind of final things that you want to talk about, Rigo, before we end this podcast?
Just, I'm very excited to see what the rest of the cards from the new campaign will be. And maybe if they release a bunch of new ones, we can either have a discussion about the new spoilers, or maybe if we are super lucky, we might have a discussion about the whole set next week.
Actually, before we go, I want to play a small game with you, okay?
All right.
I'm going to describe to you an Eternal car art. And you're going to have to guess the card's name. And this is actually a team game. Because the better my description is, the more accurate you tell what this picture is.
I'm usually not good at games like this, but...
Okay, so this is a masked woman. And she's holding a staff. And there's an owl behind her. Is that enough information?
It might be Kothan.
Might be Kothan. I could definitely see why you would think Kothan.
If that's a woman, it might be Praxis Displacer.
Yes, it's definitely Praxis Displacer. Yeah, I always had a joke with Praxis Displacer, is that is Praxis Displacer the woman in the front, or is that the owl in the back, you know? But there you go. I hope the listeners at home play along with our little game. Let us know what you think about it. I'm definitely like, I think this is a good idea. I want to do it every episode, but you know, we'll see. All right, guys, that is going to do it for this episode. Our intro and concluding music is Monody by the Fat Rat. I hope you guys enjoyed the episode, and we will see you next time. Bye, guys.
Bye.